Running Down Dogma with his karma. This is the Drew Marshall Show.
Well, folks, you know what that music means. It's time for Soul Survivor on the Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for tuning in. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. And, of course, we're live right here on Joy 1250 in Southern Ontario, covering a population of 6 million people. And I'm sure each and every one of them are listening at this point in time, because our Soul Survivor has returned from a 2-week hiatus. She went down to Mexico, have a little retreat, a little getaway, and feeling refreshed, are we, Catalina? I hope.
And tanned.
And tanned, she says with a little perky smile. Well, welcome back.
Thank you for welcome having back. Me back.
We missed you terribly.
I missed you too.
Stop it. So listen, if you are new to our program and you've not heard what we're doing here, well, let me explain it to you briefly, and then we'll get to our first guest, or our guest, our Soul Survivor guest. First, we did a thing a number of years ago called Preacher Idol, and then we did a little thing called So You Think God Wants You to Sing. Well, now we're back with yet another slightly twisted version of a hit television show, Soul Survivor. 5 religious tribes competing for the soul of one person. And, you know, listen, we're Canadians. We don't take ourselves that seriously. It's not a real sort of it's not a competition, really. There are 5 religious tribes that are explaining their belief systems to Catalina, who is our soul survivor. And this is just an opportunity for Catalina to speak with some of the more prominent tribal leaders of these various faith traditions. And so far, we've had tribe Muslim, tribe Mormon, tribe Jesus with Billy Graham's daughter, Ann Graham Lotz. And today, this week's guest is from tribe Buddhism, Robert Thurman. He is the first American ordained Tibetan monk. He's been named by Time Magazine as one of the 25 most influential Americans. Robert Thurman has cultivated a worldwide awareness of Tibet through his writing, translation of important Buddhist texts, and activism. He is the co-founder and president of Tibet House U.S., along with actor Richard Gere and composer Philip Glass, among others. And at the behest, of course, of the 14th H.H. Dalai Lama, Mr. Thurman also is Jisong Kapai. I'm not going to pronounce these things right, Bob. I'm just not going to do a good job here at all.
That's okay. Jisong Kapai.
Thank you. He's a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies at Columbia University, basically, is what I'm trying to say, holding the first endowed chair in this field of study in the United States. Bob has been a personal friend of the Dalai Lama for over 40 years and has been hailed by New York Times as the leading American expert on Tibetan Buddhism. Joining the Drew Marshall Show, Mr. Robert Thurman. Bob, I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Drew. It's great to be with you and your Soul Survivor routine.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce the two of you. First of all, Catalina, this is Bob Thurman. Bob, Catalina.
Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you.
So, as you've heard, Bob, we've heard from tribe Muslim, we've heard from tribe Mormon, we've heard from tribe Jesus, and now we really need to hear from you about Buddhism, because if anyone's going to help us understand this and kind of, you know, I guess this is going to sound right at all, but, you know, dumb it down for us outsiders,
right.
You're the guy, man.
Well, that's nice. I mean, I'm sure there are many people who can explain it better than me. But maybe I can make it more simple. I have when people ask me what Buddhism is, which I guess I should launch into that now at
this
moment.
Please do.
Okay, when they ask me what Buddhism is, what I say is it is engaged realism.
It's
basically just realism. And what I mean by that is that Buddha, 2,500 years ago, who was a prince in the North Indian kingdom, He went all out for many years to try to discover what was real in the world. Because it looked like to him that the realest thing in the world was suffering, and he was very unhappy about that. And he didn't like that being the case for his wife and his child and his father and everyone. And so he wanted to see if that was really the case, you know, that the nature of life is filled with all this suffering of, you know, sickness, old age, all this kind of thing, injury and so on. And then he discovered, to his delight, that all of those sufferings are superficial realities. They're not unreal completely, but they are superficial. And deeper down, at the deepest nature of reality, he found bliss. He found happiness. And so he came up with the teaching that other people could follow and figure that out themselves. Some people could take it like a religious thing and have faith in it, in that fact, and feel that ultimately, in the long run, they'll be okay. They'll be saved, so to speak, as you'd say if you put it in Western religious terms. Mm-hmm. And some people, the majority, however, he taught, unfortunately, in order to realize the bliss of reality, you have to understand it. So in a way, he founded a tradition of psychological science and even physical science and biological science about the nature of life. And so Buddhism's real thing is to be educational and to help people discover reality, because ignorance is not bliss, ignorance is suffering, and wisdom is bliss. You know, he turned that old slogan on his head. And that's what Buddhists have been doing ever since. Now, the nice thing about that in relation to the soul survivor is that Buddhism can get along with sage traditions who tend to teach only this way, you know, only through Jesus, only through Muhammad, only through Krishna, etc., can you be saved. You know, they get into an only through their deity. And Buddhism doesn't say that Buddha can save you, actually, so you don't have to believe in him as a savior. But Buddhism says if you understand your world and your reality, including Jesus, God, Buddha, Krishna, Muhammad, whoever it is, without leaving your religious faith and your sense of adoration of whatever figure you place over reality, if you understand it, you'll be saved, you'll be happy, you'll be able to help others be happy. And so it doesn't have to conflict, it doesn't have to compete for market share, so to speak, with any religion.
Okay, now...
That's what I like about it. So that's why we're not out to find converts, we're not out to increase our population.
Right, right. Okay, so now I have the privilege of looking across the desk here at Catalina, and every once in a while Catalina's eyes go up, and is there something that Bob said that you want to ask a little more about?
Please do, please, Catalina.
Yes.
I'm a professor, you know.
Just because I know Buddhism is a religion of the heart.
Right.
It sounds very intellectual what you're saying, understanding the world from an intellectual point of view, from a heart point of view, or both together related. And how do they relate together?
The heart and the mind?
Yeah.
Exactly, because right. I know that through meditation you free up your mind and you actually start sensing the world through your heart. That is the goal.
So does that mean in order to sense the world through your heart, you need to suppress your mind?
Pretty much. That's my question. Is that the reality of Buddhism?
Well, if you make an opposition between the heart and the mind and the intellect, then, you know, you have to say that Buddhism is a religion and a philosophy and an education of both heart and mind. But actually, Buddhism doesn't separate the heart and the intellect, because the intellect is what sort of how the heart expresses itself. And the intellect, in a way, also controls like how you experience things. It's sort of your interpretation of what you experience, you know, that is controlled by the intellect. So a negative intellect, an ignorant intellect, an intellect that holds some delusory point of view, will shut off the heart's deep feeling. Do you know what I mean? Like, everybody knows that when you make another person happy, you will be really happy yourself. And the real secret to happiness, Buddha always taught, is to be concerned for the happiness of others. You know, it's altruism. As the Dalai Lama says, if you want to be happy, be compassionate. Mm-hmm. If you want to be happy, be altruistic. You know, he always makes that statement.
Yes.
And that's what you're thinking about, Catalina, about the heart, the loving heart that wants to, you know, make others, loving meaning, wanting the beloved to be happy, so wanting others to be happy. Now, intellect can get in there and get like Ayn Rand philosophy or something and say, well, the way to live is to be selfish. And then that's actually a delusory view, because selfish people are constantly dissatisfied because they never have enough, of course. We know that. Even a billionaire wants 2 billion, you know. And so that's how the intellect can distort. But when the intellect gets clear and understands the nature of life being that when you focus on others, and you really feel their feeling in your heart, and you feel that their heart is as important as your heart, then your heart opens and you have a deeper experience of the heart. So, in other words, the part of reality, one reason why Buddha was happy, why it's blissful, is that the wise intellect will always open the heart more, and the confused intellect will close it more. But the whole intellect, you cannot open the heart just by discarding the intellect, because then you can be a victim of all kinds of delusions, you know, and it won't necessarily open the heart. Is that clear?
Does that help a little bit?
Yes,
okay.
Very much.
I just want to remind our listeners, we are in the middle of a little thing we're doing here on the show called Soul Survivor, and we're speaking with a representative of Tribe Buddhism, Robert Thurman. He is a first American ordained Tibetan monk. I know it's not cool to name drop, but Bob, seriously, you're friends with the Dalai Lama? Are you friends with Richard Gere as well? I mean, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's just some good luck. Richard was a Zen practitioner, actually Japanese Buddhism, originally, because he was a philosophy major in school. He didn't just major in girls. He majored in philosophy and is a real thinker. And so he, that's a joke, you know, he's such a lovely man, but he had 8 older sisters, you know, so he knew a lot about girls. Anyway, he was the youngest child of 8, with 8 older sisters, if you can imagine that, all doting on little brother Richard. And anyway, Richard, so then he did Zen meditation, right? And then he realized that just meditating without learning anything will not do it by itself, although meditation is important. And then he met the Dalai Lama and got very, really felt his heart move when he met the Dalai Lama and began to develop his understanding to the direction he wanted. And so then he came to work with us to help set up our Tibet house, which we have in U.S. We have Tibet houses in a number of countries. And they are kind of like cultural embassies of the Tibetan people, whose culture is kind of threatened by current events. And So the Tibet houses are kind of outposts of showing their distinctive, beautiful, loving culture, you know, happy culture.
Good. Okay, now again, I'm noticing some eyebrow raising over here with Catalina.
What's that, Catalina?
Yes, just because analyzing all the other tribes that I've heard their story for the past few weeks, everybody's talking about guidelines and mandatory practice of the certain faith in order to achieve salvation?
Sure, in some of them.
In order to get closer to God. I know Buddhism does not talk about God. There's no God in Buddhism.
No, we do. We do talk about God.
Okay.
There's a lot of misunderstandings about Buddhism. For example, you know, the Buddha, his real discovery was Nirvana, what he called Nirvana, which means freedom from suffering or happiness. And but then he said, if you don't understand the world and if you remain in ignorance, you will suffer. So then people misunderstood, saying that, oh, Buddha says you always have to suffer. But he didn't say that. He just said, if you persist on being ignorant, you will suffer. Like, you know, Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. Buddha never said the unenlightened life is not worth living. He just said it will be suffering. Now then, so then the Buddha met God, actually. Mm-hmm. He had conversation with God, like prophets did. But God told Buddha, actually, I'm not omnipotent. I'm very creative, and I'm very powerful, but I can't solve everybody's problems. They have to do it themselves. But I try to help, but I can't do everything. And please tell beings, human beings, that, so that when things are terribly bad for them, they don't blame me. You know, because God didn't like it, in the Indian version of the creator God, whose name was Brahma, he didn't like the fact that by saying that he was omnipotent, when people would have a horrible thing, you know what I mean, they would die, or their children would die, or some terrible terrorist attack would happen, then they blame God. Well, he's supposed to be omnipotent, how can he let that happen? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So Buddhism does not disbelieve in the existence of God, but it doesn't believe that God has the omnipotent power to save you. It believes that God will try to help you, but you have to understand your world yourself. And that way you will achieve salvation.
Okay.
That's the difference.
Bob, you know, a lot of my questions in regards to understanding various faith traditions come from the wise.
Yes.
And I don't mean the wise, W-I-S-E, I mean the W-H-Y. I ask why.
Okay.
Why would I want to become a Buddhist? Why? What's in it for me? And I don't, you know, look, I'm going to sound like a typical consumerist North American. What's in it for me? But why, for example, if someone is following Christ, they believe the teachings of Christ will help them live a life that is one of servitude and laying down their lives for others, and then inevitably, because God can finally look at them as perfect, God will then allow them into heaven and to live with the Creator forever.
Right.
What is the point of Buddhism?
Well, it's really just the same, except there's just some little bit differences. It's just the same, except they say that if you follow the Buddha's education, his teaching of your morals, of your mental, your psychology, and of your wisdom or your understanding of the world, then you will be in eternal happiness yourself, and you will join God there, who is there. But the point is, no one else can do it for you. That might be a difference. And so, in a way, the Jesus thing might be easier. And so, therefore, Buddhists are not trying to compete to make Christians become Buddhists. What Buddhists want for other people is for them to become happy, for them to be realistic, for them to be altruistic. And Jesus teaches altruism. He says, who shall, love your neighbor, love your enemy, even, he says. And that's what Buddha also said 500 years earlier. So they totally agree. The one slight difference, you might say, is one, Buddha doesn't say you have to do Buddha in order to be saved. He just says you have to understand the world in order to be saved. And you can do that while believing in Jesus, while believing in Krishna, while believing in Muhammad or whatever. Buddhism is not in favor of exclusivist, extremist religious views,
right,
that you have to do this or you have to do that or everybody else is doomed. And even, I'm speaking, and so therefore Dalai Lama, when he teaches in America, except for people who already are Buddhists, he says to other people who are Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or secular humanists even in background, he says, I'm not trying to change your belief system. I'm giving you tools that you can use to try to be happier, be more kind, be more loving, be more realistic, be more understanding. And if you can use those, however, in whatever religious group you belong to, and there's no need for you to join up on Buddhism. We don't need a lot of people.
Oh.
There's lots of Buddhists who are not even fully understanding, so we're not after you, type of thing.
Right.
I think that's important. He admits that there are some Buddhists who say, without being Buddhist, you can't understand the world, therefore you won't be saved. There are exclusivist Buddhists. Mm. But he doesn't agree with them, and he has his interpretation. There are many interpretations, of course, of Buddhism. There are many different kinds in many different countries. But I believe in his view, which is that it's a very open thing, and in our modern time, religious extremism and exclusivism is actually dangerous. We can see religious wars with very powerful weapons emerging in
right.
the future. We now see religious terrorism, which is very bad. And we don't want to engage everyone should try to figure out some new interpretation where they don't get into that.
Okay, on the phone with Robert Thurman, who is an ordained Tibetan monk. And you're actually a very, and I don't know why I said actually, it sounds like I'm surprised, but you're a very good communicator. I like how you're explaining things. It's actually getting through my thick, sort of hockey playing brain. So thank you.
I was left wing when I was in high school. I was a hockey player too.
And
never as good as the Canadians.
No,
I was in New Hampshire, at a prep school in New Hampshire, but we always got beaten by any Canadian team.
As you should, of course, yes. Catalina?
Yes, as I'm understanding, there's not a set mandatory practice, only common sense, kindness, and compassion, which is, to me, common sense.
But there's got to be rules. I mean, this isn't Vietnam.
Yes.
don't kill people. Don't steal their stuff. Don't harm them. Don't commit sexual, inappropriate sexuality, including adultery or rape or any kind of horrible sexual, don't abuse sexuality, in short. Those are considered the three commandments of body, and then there are four commandments of speech, which is don't lie, don't cause divisiveness among people, slander, don't speak harshly to people, and don't speak frivolously or meaninglessly, babble meaninglessly. Those are four of speech. And then there are commandments of mind, don't be malicious, don't harbor malice, don't be greedy, and don't be deluded. Don't have fanatical, deluded worldviews. and or extremist worldviews. Those are the three mental. So there's the kind of 10 commandments, although they're not in a way called so much commandment. They're called paths of skillful evolutionary action.
Guidelines.
When you act that way, other people will like you, you will be nice to them, then they will be nice to you, and you will evolve into a nicer being. And so that's what they're called in Buddhism. So you have to do that, yeah. If you kill people, if you steal their stuff, if you do all this kind of thing, then you will have a very negative future existence. Although, and even Buddhism has hell, too. It has heavens and hells, although nirvana is beyond even heaven. It's even more blissful than heaven, but any particular heaven. It's like super heaven, you know. But they also do have hells, but there's no eternal hell. That's very important.
Oh.
Buddhists believe that the compassion of the divine beings in the world, Buddhas and gods, is such, and angels, is such that they never allow anybody to be eternally doomed. And actually, Buddhists kind of understand Jesus and they understand Jehovah like that. They really think that that eternal thing that some people get off on is kind of an exaggeration of the church, but it's not really in the original teachings. They believe that, but they may be wrong, and it's up to the Christians and the Muslims to decide. But the concept of a compassionate deity and eternal hell just can't work together.
Right,
I'm sorry.
Right. Okay, all right.
So one question that comes into my mind right now would be a person that does not behave in within the guidelines of
breaks the rules,
which are to me really common sense.
Yeah.
Common sense rules. That means that they will never reincarnate, since Buddhism believes in reincarnation. That means they will forever be doomed from planet Earth?
No, never forever. It means they will go down in their life form.
Mm-hmm.
They will be, because, you know, Buddhism also has a view, a Darwinian view, that you evolve according to how you behave. But the difference between them and Darwin is that they're not materialistic like Darwin. They believe you have a soul. And then your soul will go into an ape. You can go backwards in evolution. Or a being can become an ape. An ape can become a turtle. A turtle can become a bug, actually. So it gets worse and worse if you are more violent and mean and unpleasant and stupid.
Until eventually,
you can evolve downward as well as upward, but never eternal. Nothing is eternal except enlightenment. When you achieve enlightenment, you're free of being in any negative life form, and you are just a force of love. You join with the great ocean of love of all enlightened gods and humans, and to help other beings. And then you become a creature, you become a friend of Jesus, friend of Buddha, friend of everybody. And that's eternal. And you never fall backward once you achieve that. But there's no eternal negative state,
right,
no.
Right.
And enlightenment is achieved how?
Enlightenment is achieved by realizing the true nature of reality and of yourself. And when you realize your true nature of yourself, you realize that you are totally interconnected with everyone else, and therefore their happiness is your happiness, and therefore you become a loving, selfless, altruistic person. And enlightenment means to sort of supreme altruistic person, basically. It doesn't mean just somebody with a light bulb in their head.
Right. Is the Tibetan version of Buddhism the same that the Dalai Lama teaches?
Yeah, that's what he teaches, although he makes a big point of saying all the time, which is the correct fact, that what the Tibetans have preserved for the last 1,000 years is really the final form that Buddhism evolved into in India over 1,500 years from Buddha's time. They had these big universities, and they got better with women, you know, than the Indians had been before. You know, the male chauvinist Indians had been before. They got more gentle. They got more demilitarized. They got more peaceful. And therefore, unfortunately, over the last 1,000 years, they were conquered first by Arabs and Iranians and second by Europeans, because they actually were sort of relatively disarmed and demilitarized. So Buddhism had a kind of, you know, in those days, it had a little negative effect socially, and it made people too peaceful, in a way, for a rough world. But maybe it's a crucial skill today, because now we're in this situation where we can't really have any more big wars or we'll destroy the whole planet. So we have to now learn, all our highly armed societies have to learn how to disarm, actually, which
right.
is really, really a tough, tall order.
Yeah.
And I think Christianity and Buddhism and Islam and all the religions can really help with this, if they're properly interpreted.
Good point. Good point. Bob Thurman on the phone with us, and Catalina is our sole survivor. Catalina?
Yes, I've asked the other tribes the same question. In the world that we live today, when you live a normal life, not a monk life, just a
right.
practitioner life, I find myself, it is hard always to keep those guidelines. It is hard to confront people and remain in this pool of kindness and compassion.
Right, because there's so many jerks out there.
improper English.
That was my words.
Anyway, I find myself that people are they're pushed in a corner and they have to react in ways they maybe not always like to react.
Right.
How one can break this without becoming a monk?
Well, that's true. Even monks can get angry and be violent, actually. It happens. We see some monks getting too extreme in Burma nowadays. They're mad with some local Muslims, and there's some bad stuff going on. And we saw it in Sri Lanka between the Buddhist monks and the Tamils. So nobody's saying Buddhist monks are perfect. By the way, I'm not really a monk anymore. I was a monk for a while, and then I did resign as a monk. I wasn't able to keep my monk vows really well, and then I fell in love with someone.
Oh, beautiful!
I hate when that happens.
And I married, and I have a bunch of nice kids. And then, but luckily, by having been a monk, I was open to learning something. And so I learned a lot from my wife and from my kids. I didn't act like the male chauvinist, big daddy type of routine. And so I'm sort of, although my wife says I still have a lot of chauvinist habits, but I'm trying. She says I've shown improvement in 47 years. I've shown some improvement, and maybe by 75 I will have overcome my adolescent habits.
Nice.
Of being a chauvinist.
Nice.
So now what you can do? Well, now the thing is that sometimes you just can't control other people.
Mm-hmm.
They just are too awful. But the one thing that when one is confronted by most of our troubles, if we analyze them though, have to do more with our reactions than
exactly.
with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like when somebody else says some stupid thing, and then we get all blown out of proportion and blow our top. I, for example, used to have a very hot temper. I still have some sparks left, even in my older age. And then I would overreact and cause a lot more trouble. Then that person would get even more mad, and we'd have a terrible thing. And you get into a fight, and that's terrible. So the one thing that the religious practices of Christianity or Buddhism or Islam or any of them, or even proper humanism when it's taught in a moral way, is they can teach us to how to deal with our own reactions. And like, for example, psychologists nowadays have studied anger, and they show how anger destroys your health, ruins your circulatory system, can give you a heart attack in the long run. It diminishes your good judgment. You injure yourself, you injure others, you break things you love even. Possessions even, you'll wreck cars in a temper. So, in other words, there's only studies, even from non-religious point of view, showing that one of the major things we have to do to lifelong, not just in school, and in fact schools don't do it enough, is to educate the heart where we are able to see our reactions and not necessarily go with them, question them. In other words, that's where the Buddhist practice of mindfulness, which is a very important meditation that's very popular in America and in Canada and around the world, in Europe and Australia and so on, where people learn to observe how their emotions rise and what are kind of the mental buttons that get pressed by this and that activity or this and that other person doing something,
right.
And then learn to say, I don't have to react this way, mm-hmm. and develop more internal freedom of the heart, where you can, when an inner voice in your mind says, I'm going to get that person, that's really too much, that's really crossed my line. You know how people are, what they mm-hmm. say. And then you say, well, actually, I can take it. I don't have to do this. I can make a joke instead, or I can leave, or I can ignore them, or I can laugh, and that'll really freak them out because they won't do it. Actually, Sharon Salzberg, the great meditator Sharon Salzberg, and I are writing a book just now on how to deal with anger and deal with opponents and enemies, and we got the title from a movie about a black church in the South, and it's called Love Your Enemies Because It Will Drive Them Crazy. And happiness is the real victory. And in other words, it's only through, you know, much better to be happy rather than to try to just defeat somebody else. And sometimes you have to defend yourself. Of course, it doesn't mean you have to be perfect and a monk. But, you know, the most important person to control is yourself. And the methods of doing that are very, very important. And all the spiritual traditions have very good methods to do that beyond mere belief. You know, meditational methods, intellectual methods, spiritual methods. Mm. And that's what they really are very valuable, have all of them have to offer. And Buddhism is particularly good at that, has a good psychological set of psychological systems to help people do that.
All right, Bob, wow. Can I just come and hang out with you for a little bit, sit at your feet?
Yeah, sure. I'm not at my feet, but you can just sit around, hang out with me. Yeah, sure. I'm around any time.
All right, listen, I've got a lot more questions for you. Unfortunately, you know, we're doing a radio show, and that means we've kind of run out of time here. But let me let me finish by two quick scaling questions. On a scale of 1 to 10, a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being high, 1 being horrible. I guess I should say 0 to 10.
Yes.
How much peace has Buddhism brought you? Honestly, every day, every single day, 1 to 10. Come on.
Yes, 10.
All right.
But that doesn't mean that I've been able to use all of that as well as I could have. I don't pretend to be enlightened fully.
Right.
But in the scale of 1 to 10, because the way you phrased it was, has Buddhism brought you? And what I have learned from the Dalai Lama, from the other teachers, from his teachers, is I'm almost as old as him. You know, what I've learned over the years has really, I feel, it's given me everything I need, which I haven't still used all of fully.
Okay.
But I hope to, I have used enough that I'm confident that when I do use it all, I will have full peace. So in other words, I want to make the distinction. I don't claim to have full peace, because the world doesn't have full peace, also partly.
Right.
How can you have peace when you have grandchildren? And I even have a great-granddaughter. And I'm really worried about the planet when they grow up. I really am. And so the planet is not really functioning too well, and the societies are a bit dysfunctional. So I worry about that, and I'm an activist about it. But as far as Buddhism has brought me, I'm confident it's brought me everything I need if I would learn to use it. And I have improved in that learning, and I'm confident I'll get there.
All right, the final question.
Yes.
For Robert Thurman, world famous Buddhist. It has to do with Steve Jobs. Is there really such a thing as a workaholic Buddhist?
Yes, there is. And I probably am one of them. And my wife actually calls me, I'm a Buddhaholic.
A what?
A Buddhaholic.
Buddhaholic, okay. Well, you know.
She says I'm a workaholic, but then she sometimes qualifies it as, well, let's call it a Buddhaholic.
You know, to me, what that means is if you drink enough, you'll have the same belly as Buddha. So there you go.
Right.
Listen, Bob.
I'm not supposed to drink, but I do have a little sip of medicine now and then.
Yes, medicine. Yeah, well done. Well said. Bob Thurman, again, on the Drew Marshall Show as our Soul Survivor guest, representing tribe Buddhism. Listen, thank you very, very much for your time.
My pleasure. And Catalina, thank you very much. I hope it got to the heart to your satisfaction.
Oh, I have so much more to ask you.
Yeah, there's always more.
So.
Well, with your permission, maybe she could put a few questions down and we might send those off to you. How does that sound?
No problem. I'd be very happy.
Okay.
Send an email.
Thank you, Bob.
So much.
Thank you.
I love you both. You're wonderful. Carry on with your great program.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bob.
Survive up a storm.
Okay.
All the best.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks, a short break on our show, and when we come back, it's the final stretch of racetrack with Mr. John Davis, an incredible recording artist, a beautiful voice, real smooth guitar player. If you like a little James Taylor, you'll like this guy. John Davis, up next on the Drew Marshall Show.
You look marvelous.